Blog Talk Radio.
There's a lot of music playing.
I can't hear you. So, just a second.
I can hear music.
That's okay.
Okay.
Well, good evening and welcome, listeners, and welcome to our guest, Judy Grand, who called in during our music intro. Thank you for tuning in to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, the extended edition. And that song you've just been teased with was Breath of Passion by Zingaya. Tonight, we officially begin the first week of the series called Four Mothers and Wayshowers, which will go on until February. And the guests are all top-notch, and it's my great honor to have them on the show. Our latest addition to the lineup is the noted feminist Phyllis Chesler, known for many books and her activism, but my favorite title of hers is Women's Inhumanity to Women. The upcoming Four Mothers and Wayshower series has been inspired by women and men, no doubt much like you, who have listened to the show over the past 20-plus months. To quote a fan and regular listener, Lucy Madeline, she says, "I began to pray for Goddess to show me my religion, my place of worship, to bring me to the others so that I don't have to be alone with my knowledge of her. I prayed for her to show me my calling, and she told me to go online. I got out my little phone, which I'm writing to you from right now, and I don't remember how, but I was led directly to your website. I began to listen to the archives, and Karen, I listened to show after show after show for all those days, and I'm still listening today. As I went through the archives, there was Barbara Walker and Rhianne Eisler, Carol Crist, women I have often dreamed of talking with since I was a young teenager. And to hear their voice and know they are alive, that they are real. Ever since I first began to awaken to a feminist consciousness, I began to cry out, 'Where are my mothers? Where have they gone?'" Unquote. That was Lucy Madeline's, a section of an email she sent to me. Well, the Four Mothers are generously giving more of their time and are right here every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Pacific or from the archives for you to listen to at your convenience. And tonight our guest is Judy Grand, and our topic is menstruation, the mother of us all. So please stay tuned. Now, if you're new to Voices of the Sacred Feminine here on Blog Talk, we can take your caller questions. So if you like, dial in and ask questions toward the end of the interview. That number to call in is 718-766-4662. When I see your call on the switchboard, I'll identify you by your area code and welcome you to have a chance to ask our guest a question. And that number again, which you can probably see on your computer screen, but I'll give it to you anyway, is 718-766-4662. And remember, if you can't listen live or don't want to be on the air, you can always email me some of your questions in advance. But keep tuning in each Wednesday night at 6. Don't miss us. In fact, you can join Blog Talk as a listener and have reminders sent to your email box of our shows so you won't forget about our awesome guests each week. And please, if you're a fan of the show, please indicate that by selecting us as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. Well, now it's time for that opening segment you all tell me you like so much, what's called What's the Buzz? And in that segment, I'd like to start off by announcing that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. There's a great article I got through Rhianne Eisler's website, written by her, titled Breaking the Devastating Link Between International Terrorism and Intimate Violence. It calls for our religious, political, and grassroots leaders to make ending violence against women and children a top priority. I'd encourage anyone interested in domestic violence activism to go either to partnershipway.org or Google Center for Partnership Studies, which is cps.org, or SAIV, That's SAIV, which is the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence, and read what's there about the work of groups working toward these goals. See how you can get involved. Well, also speaking of Phyllis Chesler again, I was at her website yesterday and ran across a link to an article she had posted in which she calls the Chesler Chronicles. The headline was, Egypt Wants to Ban the Burqa, France and Italy Too. So before we get to our guest tonight, I'm going to ask Judy to be just to be patient just a little bit longer because I want to share some of the important points in this article. And it goes like this. Is the burqa a religious or political statement? Finally, at the midnight hour, some European governments have begun to fight back, not against the Islamification of Europe, but against inhumane, even barbaric political practices in the name of religion, which violate Western standards of universal human rights. Thus, first France, but now Italy, have called for a ban on the burqa. Italy's Northern League proposal aims at amending a 1975 law introduced amid concern over domestic terrorism, which bans anyone wearing anything which makes their identification impossible. The Northern League also has the backing of Berlusconi's People of Freedom Party. The League's Roberto Cota said, we're not racist and we have nothing against Muslims, but the law must be equal for everyone. When France's President Sarkozy first called for a similar ban, a self-identified branch of Al-Qaeda in northern Africa threatened to attack France over this. Predictably, left-center opposition MPs criticized the Italian proposal and said it was unconstitutional because it infringes on religious freedom, and justifying it because of law and order is totally out of place. Well, we do live in an age of miracles. None other than Sheikh Mohammed Tantawi, the leading religious figure of Al-Azhar, was just the other day reportedly angered when he toured a school in Cairo and saw a girl wearing, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, niqab, N-I-Q-A-B, which means that her face was masked or possibly she was wearing a full head, face, and body covering. The Sheikh, regarded by many as Egypt's imam and Sunni Islam's foremost spiritual authority, asked the teenage girl to remove her veil, saying the niqab is a tradition. It has no connection with religion. The imam instructed the girl, a pupil at a secondary school in Cairo's Mandanet suburb, never to wear the niqab again and promised to issue a fatwa or religious edict against its use in schools. The ruling will not affect use of the hijab, the Islamic headscarf worn by most Muslim women in Egypt. Following the imam's lead, Egypt's Minister of Higher Education is to ban female undergraduates from wearing the niqab from the country's public universities, Cairo's Al-Masari Al-Yam newspaper reported. Again, though, let's not get too excited or rejoice, because then the very influential Sheikh Tantawi has his detractors as well on the fundamentalist side, who have excoriated him for supporting France's ban on hijab in public schools and for shaking hands with the Israeli President Shimon Peres. And clearly, the Egyptian government is unhappy about the gathering forces of Islamic fundamentalism, which consistently manipulate women and women's clothing as symbolic political statements. Some have even called for more severe Islamic clothing for women in which only one eye can show, and apparently that's called the Algerian style. The Egypt government understands that it is at risk vis-a-vis Islamic fundamentalists, and now some European politicians understand this too. They say, follow the burqa, and where she goes, you will probably find normalized wife beating, serious child abuse, including honor killings, as well as polygamy and a pathological hatred of Jews, Israelis, Hindus, Americans, and other infidels. There you may also find terrorist cells or supporters of terrorists. From this point of view, if you ban the burqa, and it may lead to an exodus of terrorists back to their fundamentalist-friendly home countries. But there's another point of view which interests me more. This is Phyllis Chesler talking, namely the human rights, women's rights argument as grounds to ban the burqa. Chesler says she's made the argument in these pages, and she found support from Muslim friends, first at an international conference in Rome, and now in a new book out that's on the subject, which she highly recommends. She says she's been reading the most elegant and excellent book on the subject of the Islamic veil, written by Marnia Lazrig, called Questioning the Veil, Open Letters to Muslim Women. It's carefully reasoned and beautifully written, she says. Lazreg is an Algerian Muslim feminist academic, and her mother once wore the veil. She's respectful of Muslim women's own feelings of their religious desires. She argues that the veil, face, head, and full body covering, is not commanded in the Quran, that it's harmful to women's physical and mental health, that it's mainly a political statement about fundamentalism and misogyny. She has little patience for feminist academics who themselves are not forced to veil and who play at imagining or deconstructing the veil as liberatory or as a statement of resistance. Of course, she's also on record as having objected to the manner in which Muslim women have been portrayed in books as well as in the media, namely in ways that focus on them as only being oppressed victims. As we get to the end of this here, in her last letter, Lazreg implored Muslim women to stop wearing the veil. She tells them it's a symbol of inequality, it undermines faith, it objectifies women for reasons of political propaganda, just like advertising in Western society does. One by covering and the other by exposing women's bodies. Lazreg also views the veil as harming Muslims' women's employment because the hijab symbolically inserts her into a virtual domestic space and affects how she's viewed and treated at work. She redefines modesty as related to behavior and character rather than to appearance and opposes the straitjacketing of a woman's body. Removing or refusing the veil does not mean that a Muslim woman has succumbed to the West. She writes, "Not wearing the veil is not a victory of the West. It is woman's victory over a custom that inflects her thinking about themselves as human beings. Wearing the veil is not a strike against anti-Muslim prejudice. As long as states mandate or prohibit veiling, as long as political movements advocate for it, as long as organized networks with books, lectures, DVDs, and course packets promote it far and wide, a woman can never be sure she takes up the veil freely. Ultimately, there is no compelling justification for veiling, not even faith. No one is entitled to turn the veil into a political flag." And in closing, she says she encourages that book, Questioning the Veil, Open Letters to the Muslim Woman. And in the final closing sentences here, she says, "Breaking news, a reader has informed me that the Muslim Canadian Congress has just urged that the burqa be banned in Canada. Given Sheikh Tantawi's statement and the fact that the burqa is also forbidden at Mecca, the Congress argues that it should also be forbidden in Canada." So, I just wanted to share that with you. I thought that was rather important, and you might wonder why I consistently share articles such as these and What's the Buzz. Well, it's because the programming has been so pervasive that women are inferior to men from the very beginning in the Garden of Eden. Too many women and men have drank the Kool-Aid, and I hope these articles help us to remember the state of women everywhere and help as an antidote or maybe inoculation of some sort against inequality, misogyny, sexism, or any of the other insidious isms. Okay, the bees are released from my bonnet for another week, and I'd like to turn to our guest tonight, Judy Grand, who I thank for her patience during the previous segment. And for guests who have not yet discovered Judy, let me tell you about her. Judy Grand is internationally known as a poet and a cultural theorist. She teaches women's spirituality at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology and literature at the California Institute of Integral Studies and master's programs she's helped develop. Her book, Blood, Bread, and Roses, How Menstruation Created the World, describes a new origin story based in menstrual rituals and was published by Beacon Press. Her latest collection is The Judy Grand Reader from Aunt Lute Press. Well, Judy, welcome, welcome, welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine.
Oh, well, thank you, Karen. I'm happy to be here. It sounds like you have a very lively program.
Well, thank you for being a part of the Four Mothers and Wayshower series, and of course for your patience during our What's the Buzz segment that our readers love so much. There's always some hot topic to talk about or new news to share.
Yes.
Well, Judy, let's start with what first drew you to the subject of menstruation and culture. You know, we've had other women on the show who have, you know, talked about, you know, women sort of reclaiming their sacred blood, you know, seeing it as more of an aspect of empowerment. But, your focus has been a little bit different. You've sort of gone to the past. You've seen, you know, how this has affected our culture. And was there anything in particular that first got you going on this? Or, you know, just sort of fill us in.
Riveted my attention onto my period by the fact that I had a lot of pain, as many women do. So I was never too far away from thinking about it. But what really drew me into it was back in 1973 when I was living in an all-women's household and very, very political. And we were running a press and a women's bookstore, one of the first, or probably the first one. So all kinds of information was beginning to surface and flow in. And I was very curious about what contribution women had made to culture. And I thought that surely if I investigated menstruation, I would find that it led us to calendars and time at the very least. And my mom, who didn't finish the ninth grade, had always been very interested in science. And so in a sense, in her name, I decided to see if women, in fact, had something to do with the development of science. So off I went, reading everything and trying to glean tiny little bits from everything that I could get my hands on to read that might have some information that would lead me to this. And it turned out to be a 23-year journey. So the culmination of it is that I really immersed myself in all kinds of information about menstruation, and I continued to ask that question, what did women contribute to culture? Which is a different question than the usual question of how are women treated. You know, that question implies that men created culture and then treat women in it. But the question, how did women contribute to culture, is really a cultural feminist question, and that's the one that I just very persistently pursued in order to answer my own questions about this.
Well, Judy, let me ask you, did you have a lot of trouble finding that information? I mean, we know the patriarchs, you know, the conquerors write history. So were women's voices easy to find?
No, I found that it wasn't in women's voices at first. It is now. Now it's possible to read all kinds of women from indigenous cultures are surfacing and talking about their menstrual rites and menarche rituals and so on. So there's much more information now. At that time, it was hidden. So I simply learned to decode in various ways. And gathered and gathered and gathered until finally I was really reading anthropological accounts and ethnographic accounts of seclusion rituals from all around the world, of menarche rites in which maidens are secluded or were secluded for anywhere from a few days to months and even years, and underwent various forms of education in that. And I began to see this as having something that was quite central to humanity prior to what we could call patriarchal cultures, the mass cultures coming in and overturning all of that. And I was very, very curious about it. So out of that, I began looking at the various taboos and seeing that there's a pattern of them that goes around the world. And I was just asking myself, you know, what are the implications of this? And what is the meaning of it? And by that time, a few indigenous voices were beginning to say, hey, Western women, this is not about pollution. This word pollution is not about in our culture is not about that that there's something wrong with us, but quite the opposite. It's that we are carrying a particular kind of power, certain kinds of energies. So I started to understand that certain kinds of energies, which are most comparable to electricity, if electricity was also a consciousness of the goddess, were understood to flow through women's bodies. And so a lot of the regulations had to do with energy modulations of various kinds. And the maidens were endowed with certain powers. If they would follow the restrictions, they would have the power to bring on rain or affect whether there was a flood or not, make sure the crops did well, and various things like that. So what had been couched in very negative terms by Western anthropologists who first encountered it has gradually revealed itself to be meaningful in entirely different ways than we could have imagined. So I got really excited about it.
Well, Judy, am I understanding what you just said in that it was really in the interpretation of the ethnographers that the power, that energy, that electricity that came with these maidens was sort of diminished when the ethnographers interpreted what they were seeing and hearing? They were putting it in a negative light when it really wasn't?
That's correct. That's one piece of what was happening. And another piece of what is happening is what we can see with the history of menstruation in the West is that the Western sensibility culminating with the Inquisition didn't want any loose energy and really went after people who could go into altered states, really went after a whole new category of people called the insane who were put in special institutions and then mocked and derided and tortured, people who were understood to have any kind of magical powers or close connections with creatures or power over the weather and that sort of thing. Those were subject to the Inquisition and had their property seized and, as we know, were tortured and killed, including being burned or hung or whatever in public as a means of suppression, not just of the people, but of this whole capacity to go into altered states.
Well, let me ask you about that. Do you think they were of that mindset because these women had a power they didn't possess, or simply because it was a matter of control? Because my first thought is, well, why didn't they just get the women to teach them how to do it too?
Yeah, and I'm not sure who the them is, but I think the them is probably a different cultural approach. One that's much more mechanistic and holds to rationality, number one, as number one, number two, and number three approach to life. And it was just part of the patriarchal turn, which has now swept across the globe in any number of ways, so that the rituals that of pantheistic religions across the world have been suppressed or are threatened with it for the same kinds of reasons. And that's just one aspect of what I've been exploring. That's just the energy modulation and pollution question. There are many, many other things about seclusions that I could say, and I finally did say that, this is basically the first tool. This is basically the missing link, if there's going to be just one missing link. And, of course, there doesn't have to be one. But this is so fundamental to what it means to be a human being that these seclusion rites gave us our culture. They gave us more than science. They gave us arts and methods of communication and clothing and all manner of cultural things. And that's what I have laid out in Blood, Bread, and Roses, I finally made it available online, the whole book, off of a journal that I have up there on the subject.
So the seclusion time, I think I'm hearing you say, is it wasn't just during the time of bleeding. It was also a training period.
Yes, it could be that it wasn't only a time of the maiden's first menstruation, but sometimes she would be sent to live with an aunt or her grandmother, and would stay there and learn all kinds of things. Literally, she would be going to some kind of cultural school.
Well, you know what it makes me think of, and I don't know whether these two are connected at all, but I can't. It popped into my head, so I'll just say it. I think it is it the Infancy Gospels when they take Mary to the temple priestesses. You know, you wonder if maybe that was some sort of a seclusion, you know, period.
Oh yes,
I know Margaret,
the rechurching you're talking about that after childbirth, you mean when. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I'm remembering when I was interviewing Marguerite Arrigo-Liozzo, and she was talking about the divine birth cults, and she was talking about when Mary was a young girl, and I think it was in the Infancy Gospels, they talk about as a young girl she was brought to the temple.
Uh-huh.
And she thought that's when perhaps Mary was being taught to be able to do this divine birth. And, you know, whether or not,
that's
you know.
Very interesting. Yeah. Yeah. That's the same kind of thing. And I know Marguerite, and she has done some of, in her master's thesis, she did some metaformic examination of the Demeter Persephone myth. I call my theory metaformic theory, by the way. And I do that because I needed a word for the cultural units that I thought were related to menstruation in any kind of way, and so I call them metaforms, and they're gestures or objects or ways of acting, rituals that contain knowledge and are ways that human beings contain knowledge, and that can be traced to menstrual rites or related kinds of blood rituals. Still
okay.
With me.
Yeah. Well, and I'm wondering when you went back and you started researching this, what was some of the earliest, what parts of the world had some of the earliest seclusion rites? And, do you want to share what some of those were in any more detail or anything pop up for you?
Well, they're all over the world. So they're in Africa, and they're in the areas that are understood to have produced the people who walked out of Africa and spread themselves all around the world. They're in Australia and among Aboriginal people there, or indigenous Arnhem Land people. And they're in Navajo and Apache people have hung on to them long enough that they, for two or three years, they had them up on the web, which I was so grateful for, because then I could download some of the information and show it to my students and keep it going for a while. But they very generously talked about the Navajo maiden, for example, makes a cake that it's a corn cake. It's round. It's cooked in a pit in the earth, and she doesn't eat it, but she serves it to everybody else. So that's one example of a ritual that's about sharing food with everyone. She's also, if she follows all of her rules and regs, she can help heal her younger siblings and younger boys and girls. She runs a race where she's the sun, and she embodies the sun. So there's cosmic elements involved in what she's doing, and the plants will prosper. And as we know from all these kinds of things that were collected by male historians, the negative is also true, that in Europe there probably continue to be rules whereby menstruating women were not to look at plants because they might make them wither, and all kinds of rules like that of the negative part, or that somebody could make a storm happen, that women were understood to have phenomenal powers of the world all around everyone. at the same time that, and they were positive and negative depending on whether she followed her regulations. And the word regulation itself has a European word regla, which is means menstruation. Taboo also, tapua means menstruation. So there are many ways that we're talking about menstruation when we don't even realize that we are. So these rituals, I could find them in my own family. I really didn't have to go all around the world to find all of it. It was right there in my own cultural background, even though nobody has celebrated menstruation in my family for probably at least 1,000 years and maybe 2,000. But for other folks, they still celebrate it, or they were celebrating it, you know, up to 100 years ago or 400 years ago or such. But in my family, when I grew up, I was not to go swimming, and that's a very common separation, part of seclusion rites, that the maiden is not to go into natural bodies of water because he might impact them in particular ways.
I have to share with you, Judy. When
you
said that, you brought me back to a 12-year-old girl standing in my grandma's bedroom, and I'm you know, it's the time of my menses, and I want to go swimming, and she says, "You can't go swimming when you're on your period. The blood will go to your brain and kill you."
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, I've never heard that one. That's really an amazing one. That's marvelous.
Well, my grandma had some stories, but you just brought me back instantly.
Well, you know, everybody's grandma does. You know, if you can go far enough back, every single lineage has this kind of detail about what menstruation has meant in the family, and every family, I think, has if they don't celebrate menstruation anymore. That somewhere in their lineage, there was the generation when that changed. And prior to that, they did. They celebrated it as the central part of our humanity, and it was celebrated by everybody. I talked to one young woman. I just have to tell this little story.
Sure, one young woman
in South India whose menarche ritual, she said, was attended by 10,000 people. 10,000
wow.
people turned out to help her celebrate, and that is a lot of esteem, you know.
Well, that's phenomenal. Well, you know, I guess I'm wondering, and forgive me if you've already answered this, and I haven't, you know, connected all the dots. But all right, I'm hearing you say that for a very long time, it's sort of been a double-edged sword. Depending on whether the girl follows her regs, it can be positive or it can be negative for the community, so to speak. I guess what I'm wondering is, do you think it was always like that? That it was this double-edged sword, or at some point the negative connotation started to come along with the positive, until finally, like you said, we get to the point where it's not anything good at all anymore. You know, we stop celebrating it. And here in our contemporary times, you know, pharmaceutical companies are telling us, just get rid of it, you know?
Yeah.
Were there things that happened in our timeline that you can point to, or is that just, you know, too difficult a question because
it
was
not
happening?
It's not too difficult. I found a correlation between menstruation and the existence of a goddess. In people's spiritual traditions, and the goddess, of course, never alone, always in a pantheon, always in a family, always in relationship. This is a very relational way of being. It's just community oriented, and it's connected with the earth beings and so on. But I found, and I did my I put my theory together a lot from reading and talking to Americans, because I didn't have access to other folks. But I had an opportunity to go to South India and just make an application, just really talk to people who were there and do a comparison between goddess rituals and menstrual rituals and see an extraordinary number of correlations between those two, including that the maidens often are treated as if they are goddesses when they achieve menarche and go through menarche. Not everybody, community, of course, but just some communities do that. So I'm trying to wind my way back to your question. I found that the people who could not talk about menstruation were newly newly observant Christians, that that cut it off, that menstruation was then no longer a subject that was going to be talked about. And that needs some research, because that's very curious. I find that very, very interesting.
Well, could it just be it's never as simple as, but I'm thinking, you know, Christianity was anti-nature, anti-woman. I mean, it sort of makes sense, unless there's probably more to it than that.
Well, I was thinking that the sacredness of the blood, as the blood was considered sacred, was replaced by the sacredness of the sacrificial blood, the blood of Christ.
Ah.
So maybe that had something to do with it. You know, I don't know. As I say, it needs some more. It needs some more scholars to get on it, because it's interesting and it's significant to have an origin story that centers in women's bodies in this way. It really puts women at the center of culture creation. And the two main origin stories that we have right now in the West operating, they don't do that, or they haven't done it, you know, up until maybe the latest archaeological discovery of Ardipithecus. I don't know if you've been following about her, but
yeah, actually, yes.
Yeah, and so for the first time out of that, because they're saying that bipedalism and having cooperative mates created us as humans, for the first time a female is given authority and agency in culture creation, that it's saying she was the one who picked the mate. So it's a very exciting development that's happening in archaeology. But up until this time, people have had a story that was all based on men's blood rituals, you know, that men created tools, that men had the opportunity to do it. That was Darwin's take on it, and brilliant as he was, he could not see from the generation of women that he was embedded with what women might have had to do with culture. So to change that story, in Genesis, of course, there's a woman in the story, but she's the villain, and she's vilified. So we had the choice for a long time, either she was there but she was bad, or she wasn't there at all. It was just all men creating everything, springing it out of their heads.
So what you're saying is, you know, with Darwin's theory, the whole idea of the women's menstruation probably wasn't even a consideration in how culture developed.
I seriously doubt that anybody could even say that word out loud in his time. I mean, I was astounded at how this theory was first received, by that there was the levels of taboo, the levels of self-hatred that women had about their periods. Just astonished me, and it was so much easier for me to come out as a lesbian than to come out as somebody who had something to say about menstruation. And I'm talking now about the 80s and early 90s and earlier.
Well, it wasn't that long ago. I mean, really.
It was not that long ago.
Well, going back to the men's blood rituals, would
uh-huh.
you say that, say, for instance, circumcision or tattooing, or those sort of the men's way of having a blood ritual
mm-hmm.
To mimic the woman's natural blood ritual every month?
Yeah, and I don't call it, I mean, it is mimicking, but I call it by another word, which is that they are in training with the women, meaning they're part of the family. So it's said as though men are in a state of envy, and I don't think that's right. I think they're in a state of love for their mothers and sisters when we're talking about the original peoples who put all this together, although these many hundreds of thousands of generations, that, you know, boys were part of the family, and they needed to be brought along and to come along with the cultural developments that were happening out of this new tool. It's an incredible tool to separate, to have a language to say yes or no. Yes, you can come near me now. No, now you can't. And to start wearing objects that connected directly to the moon and to the shapes of light and so on, to make a language out of the human body, which is obviously what happened, that the men had to read that, and then they began to create that for themselves. So I have a great deal of respect for what they were doing. But the women also tattooed. Tattooing was very much a part of menarche rituals. The girls were tattooed with all kinds of lines and signs, all kinds of things that are always explained as safety measures, health measures of one kind or another. It's very interesting because we all do the same thing. You know, you go to the surgeon to get cut, and it's about your health, right?
Right, right.
We've been doing that for ages and ages.
Well, now you've mentioned over and over again the maiden. Is there any difference between the the sacred blood of the woman older in life? I mean, is her menses looked at differently than the maiden's?
Well, that's a really sharp and interesting question. And I'm sure that there's not one answer, so I'm sure that we're looking at continuums when we're looking at this kind of information. There's indication from, you know, the research that I did cross-culturally that there is a slippage, that there's more negativity associated with the blood of older women less of that and more celebration around the menarchal maiden. But it depends on where you're looking, who you're talking to, what ethnographies you're reading, and so on. And in our culture, the old women, the women in menopause, and by our culture, I'm not thinking of my own culture, which is feminist, But boys in Maine who throw rocks at old women and all of that sort of thing, the crazy old women kind of thing, is completely reversed in cultures and in indigenous writings in which they say the grandmother was the most respected person in the family, that she was the one with all this accumulated wisdom. So they had it constructed that old women who didn't menstruate anymore were keeping all that power inside, and so therefore had an excess of it and could give even more to the culture.
Well, going back to the maiden versus, you know, say the mother aspect, is the delineation when the woman is no longer a virgin, does that have anything to do with it?
Oh, only in cultures that have a great deal of that put a lot of emphasis on men owning the womb, you know, and buying access to a virginal womb so that all the babies will belong to them, you know. And
yeah,
we're
I guess
talking
I'm
about
just
patriarchy
having
when we talk like that.
Well, I guess I'm just having trouble understanding why the maiden's blood was so much more powerful than, say, the 25-year-olds or the 30-year-olds or the 40-year-olds.
Well, you know why? I don't think that it was any less powerful for the older women, but I think that a lot of the cultural the length of time and the attention that were spent on her had to do with that this was an initiation, that this was her schooling, and so she wasn't busy with all of the other family raising and keeping the community together and, you know, running for office as chief or whatever she was doing. So a lot of the cultural treasures landed in the menarche rites. And another reason for thinking that is that the blood is new. It hasn't produced anything yet, so it has all kinds of exciting potential attached to it. And I think that's a factor as well.
Okay. Well, now, you say menstruation is the mother of us all. Is that because of, you know, is that a way to sort of encapsulate everything you just said, that it's almost as if from menstruation our whole culture grew out of, we just don't realize it?
Oh, I think there have been people who realized it and who have honored it. I think that we belong to a culture that for a long time has suppressed it in favor of male rituals. And we can see that really well in the stories that are told that it's men's weapons that create culture. So we're told that World War II created 50,000 new tools, as though, you know, oh, goody, that's where tools come from. That's where knowledge comes from. It's from these ghastly, horrific slaughters that take centuries and centuries to recover from. And that's a blood ritual. So it's an emphasis on men's rituals, especially the really violent ones that has characterized Western culture for a long time. So that's one reason I'm excited about this one, because if we shift it, and I don't mean go back to staying in seclusion and having all kinds of rules that would now seem really foolish. I don't mean that at all. But I do mean of respecting our synchrony with nature's cycles and our own contributions to culture and the peaceful, many, many forms of peaceful blood that grew out of this through horticulture and other places, that we can shift the emphasis away, and we must shift the emphasis away from male aggression as the center of where culture comes from. And this is an opportunity to do that.
So by doing that, that's what you mean by we have to have new origin stories.
Absolutely. That's right. And we need lots of them. This is one. And this is not alone either. There's an anthropologist in England, Chris Knight, who has developed this along a parallel axis that I did, unbeknownst to each other. He was following a similar trail, but with a metaphoric and more of an anthropological and biological emphasis than I have. I tend to go into the spiritual end and see it as linguistic and as having to do with the meanings that we have attached. And he is more anthropological, so it's more about acquiring food and sex and reproduction. I haven't put an emphasis on that, but it's the same basic story.
So if you were to say some of the biggest changes you see happening in our culture, what are some of the hopeful stories that we're getting smarter and we're reclaiming this for ourselves as women?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and people are reclaiming. People are turning away from the idea of war and free market economy as quickly as we possibly can in new theories that are coming up that have more to do with sharing and the gift economy, for example, or that life is relational, it's not adversarial. And this is a very relational theory, which is one thing that I love about it. And also this new story about that the archaeologists are coming up with about Ardipithecus as someone who chose mates that were not aggressive and who stood upright, and that's congruent with what I'm talking about as well. But I want to take on this subject of blood, because I don't think that we can have the kind of peace we need if we avoid the subject of blood altogether and try to make it all go away. I don't think that we work that way. I think that it's always has to be taken into account in some way. So what is the blood of peace? You know, what are the processions and New Year's celebrations? I mean, there's so much that's totally positive about these rituals that we need back again, that craft economies. I mean, there are all kinds of connections, way too many for me to go into right now. And right here, but I see that there's a change. I think that we've been working at this, all of this stuff as a generation now for 30 or 40 years, and I think it's going to bear fruit. I think it's actually going to lay down by 20 years from now, maybe less. There will be such new ideas, and young people will be taking them up because they work, and that there will be marked changes more than we could ever predict. I really think that's happening, really true. A lot of Artie.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was very interesting to see them say that instead of the female being paired with the male with the sharp teeth.
Yeah.
Yes, instead she's choosing the male with the teeth that aren't sharp.
That's
but
right.
He can
and
go
who brings
gather
their food home. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He can go help. He can help be a provider rather than, you know, rather than the
owner.
The dominant.
Yeah. Yeah. The dominant owner. Yeah. You know, that's right. That's right.
So yeah. That was.
That's right.
That's
and we
pretty
act.
Cool.
Excuse me, but we act out our stories. You know, we live them. They're not just stories. People live them. People who are raised to be ashamed of being female because of the Eve story go right on teaching their daughters to be ashamed of being female just because of the Eve story. It's remarkable.
It's sad. It really is sad. I mean, because even when I'm out giving talks, you know, I run into women that'll say, "How can you so casually talk about menstrual blood at the front of a room with men there?" And I go, "You know, it's just not a problem. You know,
okay.
I mean, this is part
yeah.
of our life cycle. This is our sacred blood." And you know, and I think it helps. You know, as we all do this, you know, as we put this out on the airwaves, you know, just like when women talk about domestic violence or sexual abuse, it gives other women permission to know, you know what, it's okay. It's not taboo. You know,
that's
this
right.
is something to be proud about.
That's right, and we must talk about it. It's our job to talk about it in a sense, and for me it's a spiritual calling to talk about it.
Well, you and
optimism.
I have that in common. Well, Judy, you have been delightful, and I want to make sure we give listeners your website. And I also, and while I'm giving your website, I want you to think about if there's anything we haven't talked about that you want to make sure you say, or if there's any ideas besides all of these other pearls of wisdom you've left listeners with while I'm telling listeners how to get in touch with you. For listeners, Judy Grand's book, and I highly recommend it, I have it in my library, Blood, Bread, and Roses, Blood, Bread, and Roses, How Menstruation Created the World. And her website is metaformia.com. That's M-E-T-A-F-O-R-M-I-A, metaformia.com. So, Judy, anything else before we say goodnight?
Oh, the only thing, a very slight correction, is that my name is pronounced Gran, not
okay.
Gran. But that, how would you know that? But it is.
Honestly, I've never heard anyone say it, so
yeah.
Thank you.
Well,
thank
there
you
it
for
is.
Making sure I knew that, Judy Gran.
Right.
But any other concepts about this, the subject matter that we haven't covered? I mean, I know it's huge, and we can't cover it in,
it
you
really
know,
is
minutes,
huge.
But
the only thing that I would say is that it makes people who get into this are happy. I don't know how to explain it, but there's an optimism that goes with doing something really positive and changing our stories in somewhat believable way, doing the work, doing the research, and so on, taking the time to do it as well as possible. it makes people happy. I just want to say that. It gives meaning to life.
Well, and they say keep it simple, right? And I'm just thinking from having interviewed other women about the subject who have learned to embrace it instead of fight it. I mean, they're healthier physically, they're healthier mentally, mm-hmm. They feel more empowered.
Mm-hmm.
They're happier on lots of different levels, and it I don't think you realize it until you actually start getting into this and changing the programming.
That's right, changing the programming, and that changes the culture.
Right. Well, Judy, thank you so very much. You've been a delight, and thank you so very much for being on the show.
Okay. All right. Thanks for having me on the show.
All right. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, we're going to take a short music break now, and I'm going to let you listen to a song by Jenna Green called Acceptance, and then I'm going to be right back. So please stay tuned in. Well, if you're just tuning in or you're staying here with me, and this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save our world. Well, you've heard me mention before, I'm now the LA Women's and Goddess Spirituality Examiner for Examiner.com, so please check out some of my articles. You can find them by going to the Examiner.com website. You just put my name in the search box and my articles will show up, or articles about me will show up. And very soon I'm going to have a link to these articles on my own website, KarenTate.com. My latest article is very relevant. It's called Healthcare for All, a Goddess Ideal, and it calls out leaders in our spiritual communities, no matter what the tradition, to no longer remain mute in this healthcare battle that's really unraveling the fabric of our society. You know, they like to say women's equality or feminism would unravel the fabric of society. Well, you know, we are seeing that the rising costs of health care, greed, and exploitation, these are the real evils that are unraveling our society. Well, please keep tuning in all during the fall season. You won't want to miss our Four Mothers and Waist Shower series. We have lots of women and some men scheduled that certainly fit that profile of Four Mothers and Waist Showers. I was inspired to do this series by your emails asking where are the Four Mothers, and they have heard you. So keep tuning in and hear the voices of those leaders like Judy Gron, who we had on tonight, these women and fellas who paved the way for goddess advocates everywhere. You won't be disappointed with the incredible lineup of guests. Here are just a few names to whet your appetite for the three-month series. Starhawk, Rianne Eisler, Isaac Bonowitz, Eleanor Gadden, Carol Crist, Lane Redman, Louisa Tisch. It's an awesome list, and as I said earlier in the show, we just signed Phyllis Chesler on to do the show. And also a reminder that I'm going to be teaching a series of classes January through July at the Goddess Temple of Orange County called Cakes for the Queen of Heaven. It's two classes a month, $25 a class. And if you're interested, please just go to my website, KarenTate.com, go to the Goddess Store, and you'll find information about registering either through PayPal or by sending a check. I'll be also giving a talk on November 15th at the Sophia Temple, which a lot of us goddess advocates call it, but it's otherwise known as Olindar, the home of Carla and Leigh McCloskey, on the topic of the sacred feminine for a sustainable future. And did you know there are free downloadable meditations on my website at KarenTate.com? While you're there, please, I invite you, get to know me better. If you don't know me yet, check out my two books. One is Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, which has garnered prestigious endorsements, and Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth, which won a place as a finalist in the USA National Best Books of 2008 Awards. I'd like to mention that a scholar by the name of David Hillman, who wrote a wonderful book, The Chemical Muse, he remarked that my book, Walking an Ancient Path, is an immensely pleasurable and enlightening journey that stands boldly against a patriarchal denigration of the divine feminine. I did that work in that book, and I feel like that's what I do every Wednesday night. So please go to my events page, see if I'll be appearing in a town near you, see what talks I have available to give your groups, check out my articles and links page referring you to people around the world making a difference. And you might want to take advantage of the offer I have on my website in the Goddess Store. You can get most my books for $25 plus shipping and handling. I think that's actually better than getting the books new on Amazon. So if you like what you've been hearing here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, please tell your friends and tune in, and please add us as one of your blog talk favorites. Even consider signing up as a listener and have reminders of upcoming shows sent directly to your email box, because I promise you, these next couple months, you will not want to miss one guest, not one. And I'd like to leave you with another of my favorite musical pieces, and that one is going to be, I picked it out just a minute ago, let me get back to it here on my switchboard, hang on, and it's called Wake the Dragon by the Dragon Ritual Drummers. Well, good night, listeners. Enjoy the closing with this music, and I'll see you or hear from you next week. Remember, you can email me questions, and our next guest is going to be Ann Smith of Circle Connections talking about the upcoming Sophia Conference in Bulgaria. Good night, and thanks for tuning in.